This is the ARC Energy Ideas Podcast with Peter Terzakian and Jackie Forrest, exploring trends that influence the energy business.
Welcome again to our ARC Energy Ideas Podcast for March 22nd, 2019. I'm Peter Terzakian.
And I'm Jackie Forrest.
Welcome.
Yeah, and today I want to introduce our special guest. We have Alex Porbe, who is the CEO of Synovus. Welcome, Alex.
Thanks. Hi, guys.
Good. So I think you're well known to many of the listeners to our podcast, but maybe not all. So could you just say a few words about Synovus, as well as your background, including your time at TransCanada?
Sure. So I kind of came to this industry, I think, through a bit of a unique path. For 27 years before I got to Synovus, I worked for TransCanada in the midstream sector. And in that job, I basically, I think, was chief cook and bottle washer. I did everything under the sun. And I had grand ambitions of retiring. And my retirement, I think, lasted for 4 months. And I was given an opportunity to come to Synovus, and the rest is history, probably right in one of the more interesting times to be leading a oil gas company in Canada. I'll talk a little bit about Synovus, pretty well-known company in Canada. We are one of the larger oil and gas producers in the country. We produce about 500,000 BOE equivalent production a day, about 80% of that is oil, about 20% of that is gas. And one of the interesting things I think about Synovus is the company is really blessed with extraordinary resource. We have decades and decades of very, very high quality resource yet to get to. And if we ever get back to that part of the cycle, we are pre-approved for, I think, about 825,000 barrels a day, ultimately, of oil production. So lots of runway in front of the company if we ever get back to that part of the cycle.
Just give us a sense of scale. So 500,000-ish for Synovus. Who's the biggest?
Probably CNRL. Yeah. And they would be, my recollection is they're probably just over a million barrels a day.
Okay. Yeah.
And of that 80% that is oil, is that mostly from the oil sands or is there conventional production?
Yeah, I mean, it is overwhelmingly oil sands production. You know, one of the unique things about Synovus is the entirety of our oil production is SAGD or in situ.
That's the steam assisted gravity drainage.
Exactly.
So not mining.
Not mining.
Yeah.
So very minimal surface disturbance, and we would be, by a large measure, the largest in situ producer in Canada.
Right. So you basically heat up the oil sands subsurface, not too deep, and then use wells to then draw it out, the heated oil out.
Yeah.
Alex, with your time at TransCanada, I know you were really the leader externally in terms of Keystone XL pipeline. So that's another thing that you have a lot of perspective on in terms of the challenges of building infrastructure in North America.
Yeah, for a number of years, I was responsible for all of TransCanada's development projects and construction projects. And obviously the one that got the more press than all of the rest combined at the time was Keystone XL. But I also was in charge of Energy East during its torturous and twisted path through the regulatory process.
All right. Well, let's talk about the Canadian oil and gas industry. So first of all, to put it in context, the growth of the oil sands over the past 10 years, the industry in general, has grown about 2.5 times. Back 10 years ago, there was only 1.2 million barrels a day of production coming from the oil sands. And today, the average for 18 is looking to be about 2.8 million barrels a day. And over 200,000 barrels a day of production growth last year alone. Of course, that led to the discounts that we saw. We had, over the last 10 years, $200 billion of CapEx spent by oil sands producers. To put it in perspective how much the CapEx has changed, though, recently is in 2014, there was $33 billion being spent, but now that's closer to $12 billion. So what's the future? Is the surge over in terms of oil sands growth, and is the capital spending over? And obviously pipelines are part of your outlook, I guess, on that.
Yeah, you know, I think for the time being, obviously, you know, the industry undertook all of that capital investment, I think, all based on a similar assumption that ultimately pipelines would be permittable and buildable and would be there to take away that increased production. Now, obviously, over the past several years, we've seen that that assumption, although it had been in place for 50 years, is not necessarily still effective. So as a result, I think practically, you'll continue to see brownfield type opportunities, but any big larger size projects I think they really are going to be somewhat at the whim of pipeline. One thing I should say is I personally am of the view that we are going to continue to see these pipelines. I think ultimately, I don't know if all of them will get approved or built, but I do think we will ultimately solve this problem we have in Canada. But I think even in the scenario where pipeline approval or construction continues to be problematic, I think there's lots of opportunities to get to market other ways. And I mean, obviously, my company operates one of the largest rail terminals in the province. If we were to get to the view that new pipelines were unlikely to be coming in the near future, I think there's actually a really interesting opportunity by employing diluent recovery units at rail terminals. And rather than moving diluted bitumen, you know, bitumen diluted with condensate, I think there's an opportunity to take that condensate out of the blend in Alberta and load more or less pure bitumen and move that by rail, because it has significantly more attractive economics, because you're 40% of every rail car is no longer filled with condensate. It's 100% bitumen. So effectively, you're significantly reducing your freight rate. And on top of that, you're actually delivering a product that the refiners really are interested in.
Well, we'll come to that rail notion because it's so important. And we did have James Cairns from CN a few weeks ago talking about the diluent recovery and shrimping more of the raw bitumen. But I want to get back to these numbers. And for the audience, the comment you made about brownfield and the fact that large projects, you know, the multi-hundred thousand barrel a day type project that comes on all at once, sort of those days are probably over. And now you're saying brownfield instead of what we call greenfield in the business. So brownfield is basically building off smaller quantums of new production off the existing base of assets that you've constructed.
Well, I've been in the industry for 18 months, so I have to be careful about making sweeping generalizations. But in my relatively short experience at Cenovus, I think the historical oil sands development process, it had a couple of challenges. And Peter, you alluded to both of them. One is when you're building these phases, kind of 50 or 100,000 barrels a day, they are multi-billion dollar projects. They take years and years to be constructed and brought into operation. And so number one, that is a huge strain on most producers' balance sheets. And on top of that, I mean, you're literally in a 5 to 7 year construction cycle, well, the world, as we have seen, can completely change. And I, you know, one of the things that we're taking a really hard look at Cenovus is rather than building these very large central processing facilities that, you know, are once again multi-billion dollar, we're looking much more at smaller scale pad size processing facilities. And that can achieve two things. One, you're not having to invest in these multi-billion dollar increments, but we think we can ultimately get that construction cycle down into kind of the 2 year period. And I think that you're going to see a lot more of that going forward.
So oil sands could be the short cycle supply almost at that point.
I don't know that it's ever going to be shale gas, but I do think that my company and a lot of other companies are looking at ways to shorten that cycle to market on development projects.
Yeah, much more of just-in-time delivery kind of model where you're delivering in 2 year smaller increments. Like what is smaller if it's not 100 or 200,000 barrels a day?
Like 10,000
barrels a day.
Yeah.
Yeah, I mean, I think that's also notable from a global perspective, say we had pipelines, because, you know, Jackie, you mentioned like last year we grew by 200,000 barrels per day. And what is that? That's like 15 to 20% of total global additions just coming from the oil sands.
Yeah, and that was the average, actually.
The
year we actually had grown more.
It's huge. So bringing on smaller quantums is just makes more sense.
Well, and the other thing I think not only my company, but I think almost every company in Alberta experiences, you know, when you're bringing on 200,000 barrels a day, you are really stretching the contracting community, the construction community. And when you do that, you tend to have much more challenging, you're causing inflation in terms of your construction costs, salaries. When you do it on a bit more measured basis, I think the outcome is often you're going to get a better cost outcome too.
Yeah. Yeah. Mega projects in general have a hard time coming in on time, on budget, even. And then in Alberta with limited resources, it became harder in that 10-year period that we experienced, right?
Absolutely.
Let's talk a bit about cost, because that's obviously pretty important. I think out there, oil sands has the branding of being the most expensive barrel, you know, last thing on the far right of the cost curve, you know, needing the $100 oil world. That's no longer the case, I think.
Oh, no. And, you know, it's interesting. I have spent a great deal of time in the past year really going around and talking to shareholders, talking to media, politicians, and disabusing them of that view. I mean, you look at my company alone. If you look at our capital efficiencies, like the cost per flowing BOE to bring on new production, we are just in the final stages of bringing our Christina Lake G expansion on, and we are doing that all in at about $15,000 to $16,000 per flowing BOE.
So put that in perspective. What would it have been in 2014 at the peak?
I would say it would probably be a 70% reduction from where we would have been.
Yeah, I think the going price back then, generic analysts like me would use like $50,000, $55,000, $55,000, $60,000
even. Yeah. So, and I mean, and we look at that, you know, obviously there's a little bit of benefit of the fact that the Alberta market is somewhat distressed and, you know, so labor is lower, et cetera. But we view the vast majority of that cost reduction, capital cost reduction, is sustainable because it's technology. If you were to go to one of our facilities and take a look at a pad, you would see a pad facility that is a fraction of the size it was 5 years ago. It no longer has a big heated building over top of it. It is modularized. We will build that entire pad facility in just a few shifts, 12-hour shifts of contractors versus several months to build it. And that, we view all of that as repeatable and sustainable. I mean, we're, you know, our company, we talked earlier about these SAGD well pairs. You know, 5 years ago, 800 meters was a pretty good distance for the horizontal leg. We are now pushing that to 1,800 meters. We have plans to go to 2,200 meters in places where it's suitable. And we are getting, even at 1,800 meters, we're getting good conformance. We're getting the steam situated throughout the reservoir. And anytime you can build longer well pairs, you're reducing your capital per barrel of production.
Let's give our audience a visual. So you drill down how many meters? Vertically?
It varies from a few hundred to several hundred meters.
And then you go horizontal.
Yes.
You bend the pipe and it goes horizontal for 2 kilometers, you're saying now.
Yeah, I mean, that's the capability to go. And I mean, I think a lot of people don't think about 2 kilometers, about how long 2 kilometers is. And not only in that 2 kilometers, we are steering that wellbore, you know, around areas up over, you know, the resource is not always equally distributed throughout that reservoir.
It's amazing. The drilling technology is just amazing now.
It's unbelievable what has been done over the past decade. And as I said, I mean, right now, our sustaining capital, and if you know, for your listeners to think about that, think about the amount of capital that our company has to invest annually to keep our production flat. We are right now at about $4 a barrel.
The sustaining capital, which is needed to offset declines, but how have your operating costs changed to help your economics?
So, I mean, just to, you know, over that similar time period, say 2014 to today, our operating costs are probably down close to 50%. You know, we're right now at around $6 a barrel. And, you know, when you compare that to the conventional production, the point that I think is really worth, and I make it all the time, but it bears repeating, 10 years ago, oil sands had quite high fixed costs. It was fairly viewed as a fairly high cost resource. Even my company, 6 years ago, we would say that we would need $65 WTI in order to justify bringing on any new significant developments. Right now, we have a threshold. We won't look at any project that we can't bring on that will deliver a 10% unlevered return at $45 WTI.
So 45 bucks. So what you're saying, just to recapture, what's so important is that since barely 5 years ago, the capital costs, in other words, the cost of bringing on new production, is down about 70%, and your operating costs are down about 50%.
Yeah.
And so that leads into sort of the next question. And when you reduce those costs, you're also reducing your emissions.
Yes. Yeah.
So can you talk about that?
Yeah, absolutely. One of the things about our industry, we have been far too quiet over a long period of time, I think, about the really good things that our industry is doing. So we just talked for 5 minutes about operating costs, production costs, but you know, emissions is a great story that I think most people, even Canadians, have no idea. I mean, our company alone, Cenovus, we've reduced our emissions on a per barrel basis by 1/3 since 2004. You know, part of that is having really high quality resource, but we are very focused on technology, innovation, R&D. If you look at Christina Lake, our by far our largest in-situ project, the GHG intensity on a per barrel basis at Christina Lake is significantly lower than the GHG intensity of the average barrel of oil refined in the U.S. Most Canadians have no idea that that is the case.
Yeah, especially because you're using steam. By the way, I read in your sustainability report that, and I was surprised to see that because there's a perception that if you're going to use steam, you're going to have to be pretty high carbon.
Just to be fair, part of that does have to do when you have very high quality resource, you need to apply relatively less natural gas or steam to get the respective amount of oil coming out of the facility. But we have deployed a great deal of technology downhole in order to optimize the steam that we put into the facilities. You know, I think one of the things that is worth talking about is, you know, where can this industry go in the future? And yeah, I think it's not just Cenovus. I think most of our competitors are all looking at various solvent driven or solvent assisted technologies. And the theory behind that is that if you inject solvent in addition, and typically by solvent, we're just talking about petroleum products. Typically, this could be condensate, it could be propane, it could be butane.
So it's basically like a thinner.
Exactly. It's it basically dilutes the bitumen inside the reservoir, allows it to flow easier, and allows it to flow with the application of relatively less steam. We think there's an opportunity for a further 1/3 reduction in the GHG intensity of Alberta's oil sands by applying solvent technology. And I think you're going to see the industry continue to look at that more and more as time goes on.
Well, I think it's such an important message because a lot of the opposition to oil sands, you know, the root cause is the belief that it's high carbon. And, you know, you're doing great things. A lot of people are. I actually counted out, if I consider your barrels, which are according to your disclosure report and what you just said, less than the average barrel. And then Fort Hills, which has put that out, as mm-hmm. well as Curl. That's basically 25% of all the production of the oil sands is under the average. More mm-hmm. things still changing.
Yep.
We had news from CNRL this week, actually, that they believe that Horizon, their big oil sands project, has reduced its emissions by 30% over the last number of years, too. Mm-hmm. And so that perception that oil sands is high cost mm-hmm. and high carbon, we need to get out there with that message to counter
that. Well, it was. Okay. I mean, I think the key is, there's no question, as you said, Alex, like half a dozen years ago, that was true.
Yeah.
Right. But the message is not out that it's fallen by so much.
Yeah. And can I make one other comment? And this is just a pet peeve of mine. You know, we obviously have a number of opponents of the oil sands, and we can talk about the validity of their arguments. But one of the things that I find very, very frustrating, our opponents have chosen to focus almost exclusively on greenhouse gas intensity as sort of the, Peter, to your point, when the GHG intensity of the oil sands is higher than the average production in the U.S., they could point to that and say, well, this is untenable. We have to keep this oil in the ground. And the point that I like to make when I talk publicly or I talk to politicians is GHG intensity is one element of environmental performance. And, you know, this industry in Alberta, it is extraordinary the steps and the advancement that the industry has made in terms of the surface disturbance, yeah. water, mm-hmm. remediating, decommissioning old sites. The Canadian industry, largely focused in Alberta and BC and Saskatchewan, literally are world leaders in all of these areas. And another thing that I just think this is important for Canadians to understand, if oil production from Alberta stopped tomorrow, the world would not consume one less drop of oil. It would continue to consume the exact amount of oil it consumed before Alberta stopped producing. All you're doing is changing where that oil comes from. And anybody who thinks that producing more oil in Nigeria or many places in the Middle East or many other areas is a net environmental benefit has rocks in their heads.
No, absolutely. We talked about that in our last podcast. So if you missed that, you know, listen to that, because there are our stringent environmental regulations are bar none better than most, if not all, in the world.
Yeah.
And as I like to say, if you think Vladimir Putin and the Russians are going to abide by the Paris Agreement, think again. There's really no merit to taking Canada off the supply curve when we are making these gains. But the point remains, we've got to get the message out.
Yeah.
And I think that that's really been lacking. So, Alex, let's turn to what we were talking about before the rail. But before that, obviously, the rail became an issue with the curtailment. So do you want to talk a little bit about that curtailment, your views on that, and where we're at?
Sure. You know, I think it would be fair to say that I personally and Cenovus were pretty front and center on that curtailment dispute. And, you know, by Q4, you know, by kind of October of last year, it was becoming very, very apparent to me that we had reached the maximum takeaway capacity of our pipe system. And, you know, the old supply and demand rules started to apply. And what was happening is the marginal barrel started setting the price for every barrel in the province. And we saw differentials, which had averaged probably kind of in the teens for the overall for the first three quarters of the year. The discount on our heavy oil was going from teens to 45, 50. I think it peaked as high as $52
below.
A barrel U.S. below WTI. And you did not have to be a rocket scientist to realize that if that continued for any length of time, it was going to be disastrous to our industry. It was going to be disastrous to our province, both in terms of employment, GDP, royalties. You know, the calculations we had done is if the province had remained at a $40 differential, it would have been a $10 billion loss in royalties to the $8 to $10 billion.
I think for almost a week there, I mean, we were at $10 a barrel or some really low price.
Well, there was a point in early December where we were losing $5 a barrel for every barrel we pumped at Cenovus. And we are the lowest production cost oil company in the province. So if we were losing, as I said, this is a factor of economics. There was a very, very small surplus of production versus that takeaway capacity. And I, you know, we had estimated it was probably somewhere in the realm of 300 to 400,000 barrels a day, but that was driving this wholesale destruction of our economy. Here we are now at getting towards the end of March, and I think we've seen that the curtailment, although it was very contentious, it'd be very hard to argue that it hasn't delivered the positives that
I think it's certainly been a net positive. So, Jackie, the update is that the government in December did 325,000 barrels a day, like Alex said, about 8%. Mm-hmm. Where are we at today?
Well, there's been a number of announcements even this week, and I think at this point they're saying around June that cut will be almost half of that level.
Right.
So, big change. There are people that, you know, say that it hasn't been successful because we've had this fall off in the crude by rail volumes. Mm-hmm. So, how would you respond to that?
You know, my response, and I've heard this quite a bit, and my response is, for goodness sakes, we've been in this for 3 or 4 months, right? You know, like, give it a bit of time. It was never going to be an exact science. And I always said, both publicly and to the government, I mean, as much as my company enjoys $10 differentials, more than $50 differentials, they should endeavor to have a level of curtailment that would continue to ensure that it's economic to move rail. Now, I would tell you, it's really important to note, the right way to look at whether rail is economic is not to look at the discount from WTI. It is to look at what is the value of a barrel of heavy oil in the U.S. Gulf Coast. And right now, and for most of this year, heavy oil, Canadian heavy oil in the Gulf Coast has been trading at a premium to WTI. Mm-hmm. So right now, we have contracted publicly, we've contracted 100,000 barrels a day of oil by rail. We are not losing money moving oil at these netbacks because of what that heavy oil is worth in the Gulf Coast.
So
right now.
100,000 barrels a day. So you have now actually contracted a supply chain for how long? Like a couple years?
3 years.
3 years. So yeah, that's pretty significant. Now, so really for the first time since they started building rail loading and unloading facilities here in Canada and down in Texas, that we now have the supply chain really starting to gel as a viable alternative to pipe.
Yeah, and I mean, I want to be clear. I worked for a very long time in the pipeline industry, and I would say if you want to move a large volume of oil over a large distance over a long period of time, pipes are still preferred. They are generally more economic, but at the same time, rail is safe. Rail is increasingly economic, and as I said earlier in our discussion, I think there's actually a great opportunity to start moving undiluted bitumen ultimately by rail, which actually completely removes the safety issue because that bitumen will solidify in the tank cars, and then it literally becomes a completely inert substance, and you pick it up with a shovel or a backhoe. If in the unlikely event you had a derailment.
So how willing do you think the industry and Cenovus is to doing significant quantities of that now?
Yeah, I mean, we're taking a really hard look at it right now. And don't get me wrong, DRU, this processing unit to remove the diluent from blend, it's a processing unit. It probably, you know, I would probably ballpark it at somewhere less than $1 billion for 100,000 barrels a day DRU. So it does have a not insignificant capital cost. But as I said, if it effectively reduces your rail freight rate by 40% and gives you a premium product that you can get a premium price for at the refinery gate, you know, there's a pretty good argument, I think, that it could pay for itself.
Yeah, I think the sentiment is starting to change with all the pipeline issues and all the regulatory issues as well.
Yeah, and you know, the other thing is it makes rail a long-term solution that can compete with pipe and be part of the mix for a long time to come, where today, the way we do it, it's when pipes come, it will be hard for rail to continue because it's more challenging economics.
Well, and I think, I mean, I have a lot of sympathy for the rail companies too, that, you know, they've actually, my experience, I mean, I think they've come to the table for our industry, and, you know, they've certainly have shown their willingness to make capacity available, but they want a business that has some longevity to it, and they don't want to be the swing transport mechanism. You know, one day they're moving 100,000, next day they're moving nothing. And so I think it's a win-win both for our industry and for the rail industry.
Yeah, I mean, that's such an important point because they have no incentive with such volatility to be part of the solution. But now with contracts and potentially with this diluent removal, they're going to be a longer-term player.
Yeah, and you know, one other point just before we leave rail that you had made the comment that, you know, with $10 differentials, people are starting to kind of back away from rail. If I had one message I would send to the industry, it's that I think people really got to be thinking about egress out of our province over the long term and making decisions that are going to maximize the benefit over the long term. And from, as I said, from my perspective, we've gone ahead and contracted 100,000 barrels. Nobody should assume that the government is going to remain in the curtailment business forever. And if ultimately we need more oil moving by rail, and I would encourage my peers, although you might save a buck or two in the short term by taking advantage of curtailment, ultimately we still need more oil moving by rail. And I would encourage people to think about the longer term.
Okay, let's switch the topic to Bill C-69 and Bill C-48. These are two bills that the federal government is thinking of putting in place. Can you tell me a little bit your perspectives on those bills? And what do you think the industry should be doing? Are we doing enough? Should we be doing more?
So Bill C-69 is the bill purportedly to modernize the regulatory approval process for federal energy infrastructure projects, and Bill C-48 is the tanker ban in northern BC. My view is both of those bills, without significant modification, are terrible for our industry. They're challenging for Canada. I think industry has been working really well. We have made it for a very long period of time. I think industry has been a very cohesive, collaborative voice to government saying, you can't, if you implement these without modification, you are going to cripple the energy industry in our country with all of the follow-on effects that would come from that in terms of our economy, our GDP, employment. For a while, we had a challenge in convincing the government that that was the case. They seem to now be at the table with a willingness to consider modification, amendment. Bill C-69 is now in the Senate chamber, and what I am hearing back from the various teams that are working on it is that it looks like the government is agreeing to moderate their perspective. But I cannot state strongly enough how important it is for our country and our industry that we work with government and get a better outcome.
But would you agree that modifications to the regulatory process for energy infrastructure do need to be revisited, given that, you know, we do have a new world here of environmental social forces and issues? I mean, we had the long-standing NEB processes mm-hmm. that were sort of grinding the industry to a halt. I mean, we haven't built these pipelines.
Yeah.
There is an argument to say that we do need to modernize mm-hmm. the regulatory process. Would you agree with that?
I don't know if I like the term modernize. I actually think one of the great problems with the regulatory process is it has been, over the last number of years, politicized. Mm-hmm. And in a perfect world, there were many elements of the NEB kind of 10 years ago. It was a purely professional, independent body. They not only made recommendations to cabinet, they granted permits. The modifications that were made originally under the Harper government, now the NEB merely recommends to cabinet, and then cabinet makes a decision. I just think it's a practical reality of politics that pipeline decisions are always going to be political. You never know where you are in the political cycle, if an election is coming up, if, you know, there's other challenges facing government. What's happening are these standard kind of regulatory reviews that are done in every country on earth are now becoming intensely politicized. I mean, I don't know that we're going to get away from that politicization anytime soon, but for me, and the message I give to the federal government is, guys, our industry is not looking for a free pass, anything from it. We want a very intrusive, tough, transparent regulatory review process for whether it's pipelines or major energy infrastructure. But at the same time, what the industry needs is a blueprint of what it is going to take. What are the criteria you're deciding on? And you have to know that if you meet the criteria, you have a very mm-hmm. high likelihood of getting a permit. And that requires taking a lot of the politics out and being very, very clear about what steps you need to meet, what thresholds you need to meet. One of the biggest problem that I have with Bill C-69 is I would look at the original bill as put forward. There is a great deal of uncertainty. The intersection of sex and gender in pipelines, I don't know what that means. But I do know that if someone doesn't like an outcome of a permit, they might go to a court and seek judicial review. And then a court will get to decide what some of these terms mean.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, no, we've spoken on our podcast several times before that the regulatory process has spilled over into politics, spilled over into the judiciary, and basically completely fragmented. And mm-hmm. that fragmentation has resulted in uncertainty mm-hmm. in the investment community or companies like Cenovus that invest into mm-hmm. the ground.
Yep.
And so everything starts to get paralyzed, and you're just looking for some sense of certainty, some sense of trust that if a decision is made, then you can go ahead with that decision.
And frankly, what the criteria are that we need. We don't care if the bar is high, just tell us what the bar is so we know if our project can meet it. One of the points that I would leave you guys with, contrast Canada to the U.S. And I'm not just talking about the Trump era U.S. I'm talking about President Obama's 8 years in power. Over the last 10 years, when Canada has not been able to build a pipeline for love or money, both under Obama and now under Trump, the U.S. has built millions of barrels a day of pipeline takeaway capacity to get their growing production out of the production areas and to global markets. Mm-hmm. And Canada, we have to have a good, disciplined, transparent regulatory process. We have to stop being the Boy Scout of the world and holding back our industry when no other country in the world is doing what we're doing right now.
Well, I think you're right on, but it also takes people like you, and we commend you for coming on our podcast and also being vocal in the media. But, you know, I sense that voices like yours need to get out to talk about the good news stories. We talked about emissions. Yep. We talked about technology, bringing costs down. We've got to get out of our echo chamber.
I couldn't agree more, Peter. And as I said, I think for 50 years, executives in our industry have really thought, look, we care about the environment, we care about the economy, we care about employment, we're doing all the right things. Word of that will get out, and we don't have to get on a soapbox and defend our industry. And I think all of us now understand that that isn't a strategy anymore. We, you know, whether it's guys like me, it's CAP, it's our various industry organizations, we all, I think, have realized that we have to become more vocal. We have to talk about the successes, the wins, the advancements. And we just can't sit and turn the other cheek and take punches, particularly when people are lying about our industry, which goes on with distressing regularity.
All right. Well, on that, I think that's a great point to end. I hope you've inspired our listeners to get on their own soapboxes and get more vocal, because it takes many, many people to change perceptions that are out there for a long time. So thank you so much for coming on our podcast today.
Yeah, thanks a lot, Jackie.
Yeah, thanks. It's been great talking with you.
Okay, great, guys.
For those of you that enjoyed the podcast, please rate us on iTunes or whatever app that you are listening to, and please tell someone else about us.
For more ideas and insights, visit arcenergyinstitute.com.